Risky Business, Revenge of the Nerds, Better Off Dead, Moonlighting, Supernatural, American Dad, New Girl. What they all have in common, these movies and TV shows, are Curtis Armstrong. A comedic second banana to a litany of major stars, Curtis is forever cemented in the public imagination as Booger from Revenge of the Nerds. A classically trained actor, Curtis began his incredible 40-year career on stage, but progressed rapidly to film and TV. He was typecast early, and it proved to be the best thing that could have happened. He writes about it all in his new book, Revenge of the Nerd, and it's a pleasure to welcome Curtis Armstrong to the roundtable this morning. Curtis, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
What brought you down the road of saying that you would like to write a book and write a book about your career?
It was one of those things where, because I never throw anything away, I wind up with, you know, two or three trunks full of, you know, junk mainly. But going through them a few years ago, realizing how many things I'd kept relating not just to the movies, but to my training, to my theater work and all the rest of it, family things, and I just decided this had to have been worth something, particularly the movie and TV career, which is now, you know, 40 years on. So I just started sorting all the stuff out, diaries, journals, letters, documents, all sorts of things, and started.
You start the book where you pretty much started your life in Detroit. At what point did you know that acting was for you and something that you wanted to pursue?
That was something that came about middle school, I think, and I was having a tough time. I was a nerd, although we didn't self-identify in those days as nerds, just being picked on and ostracized in general. And I was in the middle school and had been in Switzerland for several years, and while there had sort of acquired a slight English lilt to my voice, because all of my friends were English, all of my teachers were English, so I was a real target in the northern suburbs of Detroit in those days. So I didn't really know where to go or what to do, and the school brought in a new drama teacher who was an actual actor, had made a living on the stage, and he changed everything. He was the one who introduced me to the idea of theater as something to do, and encouraged me because I appeared to have some talent in that area. And that changed everything. By the time I was in high school, I knew that was where I was going to go.
By the time you got the first role, the first film role in Risky Business, you spent years in theater.
Right.
And you were comfortable there, but you were still looking to branch out and to do something else.
Kind of, except not really. I mean, my dream was Broadway. You know, I wanted to work on Broadway. I wanted to work in the West End. That was what I really wanted to do. I had been trained to be a stage actor, and that was my goal. I had no interest or desire to go into movies, and certainly not into television. It was just not on my radar at all. But I had done a play in New York that had gotten some attention, and so started getting auditions for film. And the first one that I got was Risky Business. I thought it was a fluke. I thought, okay, I'm going to go to Chicago and do this film, and that will be the end of it. And I'll go back to my theater work, which is why I kept a very detailed diary while I was in Chicago during those weeks in 82, because I wanted to, down the line, remember what it was like to make a movie.
The other great thing about that, of making that movie, is that you're playing a high school kid,
yeah.
And you're damn near 30 years old at this point.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's a genetic thing in my family that we all look way younger than we actually are. And I used to hate it at the time, particularly these things, because I was always, you know, I would wind up getting cast as teenagers, basically. and I was 30 years old, and I wanted to be taken seriously as an adult man. But yeah, that was weird. Everybody else, Tom Cruise was 19, Rebecca was maybe 21, I don't remember, but we were all, you know, they were all young people, and I was sort of the grand old man of the cast.
Do you find yourself just by that, that you're the older person in the group, that there is a that there is some teaching that goes on? I mean, this is one of Tom Cruise's first roles, major
right.
film roles as well.
Mm-hmm. Not really, no. I never felt that way because I had never made a film. He had made three at least at that point, maybe even four. So he knew a lot more about the process than I did. So if there was any teaching going on, it was Tom teaching me.
Mm. When you think of that film, and I'll probably ask you this twice during this interview, but this is the first time, because it certainly applies with Revenge of the Nerds as well. Obviously, having no idea that the film, that character, would have as much cultural significance as it does today.
They had a thing with the character of Miles in Risky Business, the famous scene where he says, "What the F?"
No guts, Goodson.
Yeah. You know, only when it came right down to it, I just wasn't attracted to it.
Should never stop you.
You seem too big.
It could have worked out.
I figured I would have gotten into trouble somehow.
God, sometimes you gotta say, "What the f-?" Make your move.
That's easy for you to say. I mean, you're all set. You're probably going to Harvard. Me, I don't want to make a mistake, jeopardize my future.
Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future.
And that was what really became very strongly connected with the movie. It was like it was a philosophy or something. And it was partially in the writing of that scene, and it was partially in the earnestness and the sort of sleazy self-assurance with which I delivered it, that somehow it just became very strongly connected. And a lot of people say, "Oh, that's my life philosophy as well." As far as Booger, though, I'm lost on that one. I mean, I kind of get it now. It's been long enough, and I have distance enough where I can look at it and say, okay, I get what people see in him. But I didn't want to do it at all. I just thought it was an appalling character, and I really didn't want to do it. But of course, you know, being an actor, they offered me some money, so I did it. But it sort of went against the grain for me, the whole movie, initially, Revenge of the Nerds.
I want to get back to Revenge of the Nerds in a second, but let's just take a step to, before we leave it, go to Risky Business. For me and my friends, when we were growing up, and we were in high school when that film came out, that your line of, "I've got a trig midterm tomorrow and I'm being chased by Guido the Killer Pimp."
This guy, Guido, he's a manager?
That's right.
Or a pimp.
Well, now that's quick, Joel. You always been this quick, or is this something new?
I don't believe this. I've got a trig midterm tomorrow, and I'm being chased by Guido, the killer pimp.
I mean, that was the line that we said just, oh, that was a great, because every kid, I think, sort of, maybe not feels that, like that, but you know, you're sort
yeah,
of
no,
being dragged
no.
against your will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was you know, this little injection of reality into this surrealistic, you know, suddenly very noir movie where you know, we're in this process, and that sort of recalls the fact that these are in fact basically children, you know, at least, you know, Tom and I were, our characters were. So yeah, I know that line always just killed.
So, Revenge of the Nerds, when it becomes so popular and there is, and you've got a hit on your hands, does that alter your feeling about it? You talked about the reservation of making it. So,
yeah.
does that alter how you look at it now and how you see that it strikes people? Yes, you may not understand it, but does it still make the process a little more enjoyable knowing that it was a smash?
Oh, it's totally, totally changed. I mean, but it had even changed years ago. I mean, you know, decades ago, because so many people, I mean, countless people have told me what Revenge of the Nerds meant to them. The people who were nerds themselves, for them, this was really almost a dream. The idea of a group of complete outsiders, these you know, totally different people who wind up, you know, under siege by powerful jocks at this college, and they have their own house and they rely on each other to succeed, and then they eventually do. I mean, when we were done with the movie, we had worked so hard on it. I mean, we had, with the writers and the director and the producers, we worked like crazy. I mean, they had a week where all we did was work on the script. And all we did was get together with the director and the writers and say, well, you know, pitch ideas and pitch jokes and what was motivating these people, trying to figure out who they were, because Jeff Canoe, who was the director, was insistent upon the fact that these be real characters within the style of the time. You know, I mean, obviously it's not, you know, O'Neill, but that was what he wanted to do. He said, if you make them real, they will be accessible to people and relatable. And so that was what we worked so hard on. So when we went to Tucson with this, you know, not really very good script, we were all sort of, approaching it as a job. And by the time we were done filming, we realized that it was something that we were actually proud to have been a part of. You know, for whatever faults it has, we were proud of it. And then over the years, we began to realize it wasn't just a matter of having done that. It was a matter of other people, many, many, many other people, for whom it was an enormously important movie.
One of the things that I find so interesting about your story and the story that you tell in the book is that after that, you don't seem to have, and maybe you'll disagree with this, I don't know, but you don't seem to have been typecast, because you have had a very successful career as a working actor for your wife. And that is, I mean, that certainly seems for people who at a young point in their life had very successful films often do not keep that pace up. And you have managed that quite nicely.
Well, thank you. Yes. But, you know, I think there's a difference. What I've noticed is that there's a difference between being, you know, forever associated with a character and being stereotyped, because obviously, you know, I will be Booger no matter what else I do.
Dawson, Dudley.
Call me Booger.
All right. Booger. Raheem, Taj.
Excuse, please, but why do they call you Booger?
I don't know.
You know, it then becomes a question of just embracing it or making yourself miserable about it. And long ago, I wanted to embrace it. So that's one thing. But your point about stereotyping is true. I never played another role like Booger after Booger. I mean, I played Booger 4 times, which was possibly 3 times too many, but it never affected my career. I continued to work in theater and TV. I went on to do some feature films and moonlighting on television and, you know, lots of other stuff. And, you know, it goes right up to today. Part of the reason that I think I've been fortunate enough to have a career this long is because, you know, I'm sort of, as a character man, they tend to have longevity that leading men or juveniles don't have. And that's been fortunate.
You know the thing you were talking about doing Booger four times and the sequels to that film. But by the same token, if someone's willing to give you a check.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know what? Yeah, that is absolutely true. And yet, there was something in it which went beyond that. Now, the truth is that the guys on that those films, we're friends. I mean, we still you know, socialize. And it was fun to get a phone call and say, well, we're going to go back and do another one, you know, and you always hoped it would be great. And, you know, they were okay. They weren't up to the standard of the first one. But, you know, obviously they were paying us, which was great. And I don't know if we would have done it for nothing, however much we loved each other. But it was a combination of things. We felt protective in a way of those characters. You know, unfortunately, there were limited ways in which we could actually protect them. You know, I mean, I guess the ultimate way of protecting them would have been not to have done any of them again. So then people just remember it from the one film. But that's just not practical. You know, we're actors. We have to work.
Well, the name of the book is Revenge of the Nerd, or The Singular Adventures of the Man Who Would Be Booger. It's a delightful read and really fascinating. And I thank you very much for sharing with us. And I wish you all the luck in the world with the book.
Well, thank you so much, Joe.
Great
pleasure. Nice talking to you.
And to you. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Revenge of the Nerd. Curtis Armstrong is the author, published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.